This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Welcome to Save a Pooch on Pet Life Radio. Thank you for listening in today. I am Beverly Isla, your host. This episode is dedicated to understanding rescue dogs and the journey of rehabilitation and trust building. And our guest today is Debbie. She's an advocate for rescue dog rehabilitation. And her journey into the world of rescue dogs began in the mid-70s when she noticed the increased number of terrified pups entering homes, and her experiences have given her a deep understanding of the challenges and rewards that come with rehabilitating these pups. So when we get back from these messages, we will hear from Debbie.
Take a bite out of your competition. Advertise your business with an ad in Pet Life Radio podcasts and radio shows. There is no other pet-related media that is as large and reaches more pet parents and pet lovers than Pet Life Radio. With over 7 million monthly listeners, Pet Life Radio podcasts are available on all major podcast platforms. And our live radio stream goes out to over 250 million subscribers on iHeartRadio, Odyssey, TuneIn, and other streaming apps. For more information on how you can advertise on the number one pet podcast and radio network, visit PetLifeRadio.com/advertise today.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Save a Pooch. We are talking with Debbie, an advocate for rescue dog rehabilitation. Thank you for taking the time today to share your experience of helping rescue dogs and their rehab journey, which is what we are all about. So let's start by discussing your early experiences as a pet sitter, particularly the transition from working with dogs from reputable breeders to encountering rescue dogs. So how did this shift in your clientele and your understanding of the needs of rescue dogs?
I was a pet sitter starting in Connecticut in the mid-70s. And in the beginning, most of my clients had dogs who had come from reputable breeders, and these were friendly, relaxed dogs. But by the late 1970s or early 1980s, more and more people had started adopting dogs from shelters. I don't even know if there were that many rescue groups at that point. But anyway, these were not dogs who had come from a reputable breeder. And the first thing I noticed, Bev, was how scared they were. Some of these dogs would just, I would walk into the room and the person would be there, or the people would be there, and the dog would be shaking, just uncontrollable shaking. So I kind of shifted my focus with these particular dogs. How can I reassure them? How can I bond with them so that they can relax and trust me? And, you know, the first time that I took care of them, the first time or two sometimes, it was really difficult for them. Eventually, they got to know me and they got to know that I was trustworthy, but it was just a totally, totally different experience with these dogs.
What you said earlier, I find it very interesting. Like in the mid-70s, you didn't encounter a lot of rescue dogs, and then it started growing.
Yes, this was in Connecticut, and more people had become aware of the fact that there were these mutts, you know, these dogs who needed homes. And I think more and more people were motivated to help them. Before that, it was almost a status symbol to have a purebred dog. You know, oh yeah, we have this golden retriever and she came from this breeder, and, you know, we've gotten two other dogs from her before. And, you know, it was just part of, and then more and more people started to open their hearts and their homes to these dogs who were in shelters, which was great.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice. But I'm pretty sure the breeders probably didn't like that part.
Probably not.
Now, can you share with our listeners some of the key indicators or, quote, triggers, and I'll ask you to clarify what that word is, that you've learned to recognize over the years when it comes to rescue dogs?
Trigger, the simple answer is a trigger is anything that triggers a dog. But let's step back a second. I'm going to share with you a trigger in my own life. Okay. I was born late in the year. So when it was time for me to go to kindergarten, I was still pretty young compared to a lot of the other kids in my school. My mother had to take me to the kindergarten class, Bev, five times before I would enter the room because I was triggered by this group of kids. I didn't know any of these kids. I didn't know what they were doing. It was a big room with a high ceiling, and I was absolutely terrified. And I basically pitched a fit. You know, I would not step foot in. And I wasn't that kind of kid. I really didn't ever have temper tantrums. So if you kind of take that description, a trigger for a dog can be, gosh.
Anything. Jeez.
It can be a person wearing a hat. It can be a big crowd of people. It can be loud noises, thunder. Sometimes even smells can trigger a dog. Anything that is very, very unfamiliar. And I just want to preface this too with some dogs are just born naturally confident. You know, they jump all over everything and they're the first one to greet the new person or the new dog. Some dogs are much, much more timid, much more shy. And most dogs fall, I think, in the middle. Most dogs are a little bit shy here and more confident there. But if you get that shy dog and that shy dog has come from, you know, a shelter, oh my goodness. Ooh. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So you were able to, I guess, see these, even that word triggers me, but for you to be able to recognize those, it would take, I don't know, I'd say the average person, it would take a bit to see what's normal and what's not, right?
That was one of the things I learned early on. Two things helped me a lot. One was to just start to be, you know, very observant, you know, very gentle with them, very slow moving, slow talking, nothing abrupt, nothing, you know, too excited. And also just kind of casually keeping a really close eye on them. So, and the other thing I did was to take them for long walks. That seemed to distract them. You know, once they got their nose to the ground and they weren't, you know, staring at me, this new scary person, once they started to just kind of get into being a dog again outside, they could relax. And then I could just kind of hang back, you know, 6 feet behind them on the leash and just watch and see, and what did they like? What sort of set them off? And so the power of observation plus exercise to mitigate that high level of anxiety, high level of fear. And I have to add, sometimes too, not usually, but sometimes it wasn't just fear. Sometimes it was actually aggression.
Yes. Yes. I've seen that plenty of times. It's funny. It reminds me of the days when I used to dog walk, and I would always get the rescue dogs that was very, very skittish, scared. And every time I'd get that dog, I was like, oh boy, this is going to take some time for rehab to go on a group walk. Mm-hmm. But I'd always begin right off the bat with bringing that dog in a group, but with a leash on. And usually if they lived in a condo, I'd always take some time to warm up with the dog and we'd run around the hallways just to get that dog out of like a panic mode. Because yes. I'd have to find this dog when I walked into their home. It would be in a corner somewhere. So that took some time for me to even get the leash on. But after, I would say, weeks, these kind of dogs would be running around in the off-leash dog areas, like running. And I'd be that person jumping up and down. And people are like, why are you doing that? It's like, oh, you have no idea what this dog has just come from. But yeah, so I really commend your work on that.
And back at you, Bev, because, you know, you stopped and you took a breath and you honed in and you waited. You didn't, you know, just run right over the dog and try to clip the leash on or something, which is
right.
Actually send them into even more panic. You just have to take it very slowly, very step by step. What I learned later was that whole process of taking things very slowly, step by step, is called, it has a name. It's called systematic desensitization.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Three and four syllables, you know?
Right. the medical term for what we were just talking about.
Exactly. It actually has a formal term. I didn't know that in the beginning, but when you think about it, you know, what I tried to do was put myself in that dog's paws. What was that dog experiencing? And how could I help the poor dog just, you know, calm down and actually even maybe enjoy our time together? So the combination of slow, you know, little baby steps and some exercise and some diversion made all the difference in the world.
Right, right. Yeah, that makes sense. Especially with some of them, just the car rides can be so therapeutic.
Mm-hmm.
So if people would just do that and not even go anywhere, but just drive.
My dog, Bev, had all the bank tellers trained. She'd be in the back seat. Oh, yeah. You know, and they would see her in the back and I'd roll the window down and, does your dog want a treat? And it's like, yeah, sure. Oh, yeah. She loved that. I think, too, that there may be something about the motion of the car because, you know, like, have you heard moms talking about when their babies are really just crying and crying? They sometimes, in desperation, they put them in the car and strap them in the seat. And in, you know, 10 or 15 minutes, the baby's falling asleep.
Yes. Yeah, exact same thing. Exact same thing. Now, what are some common misconceptions people have about rescue dogs and their terms, and how can we work to increase their understanding of these misunderstandings?
I'm going to make a really broad general statement here, okay? And I'm sure some of your listeners will disagree with me, but dogs who end up in general in shelters or rescue groups usually didn't get there because they had an easy start in life. I would say for the most part, when a dog ends up in a shelter, it's often because the person or the people just don't understand how they can spend even 10 or 15 minutes a day with their dog, bonding with their dog to socialize them, to expose them to new and different things so that they're not frightened all the time. It's a small investment in time. It's kind of like sitting down with your kid who's really stuck on their science homework. You know, they're just, I just don't get this Jurassic period. What does that mean? You know, if you sit down for 10 or 15 minutes with your kid and explain that, or explain fractions or something in math, I mean, that can make a whole huge amount of difference in that,
yes,
child, you know, subsequent time in school. And the same thing is true with dogs. The more time we invest in our dogs, try to understand them, try to bond with them, try to help them, the more we get to know them, the stronger our relationship will be. And, you know, I mean, my dog eventually, she got to a point where I'm pretty sure if I had asked her to try to do a backflip, she would have tried.
Yeah, I completely agree with your opinion. So thank you for bringing that up. And that this is probably for another phone call. But when you mention spending time to bond with your dogs, there are some cultures where that's just not a thing. These dogs are just for outdoor guardians. But that's another rabbit hole.
Well, and then, you know, what's fascinating to me, though, too, and this is a little bit off on a tangent, is do you remember Chaser, the border collie that who had the incredible vocabulary?
Oh, my gosh. I'm thinking of Lassie. No, I don't.
Chaser was a black and white border collie, and she was featured, this is now probably, 10 years ago or so, on, like, I think she made it to 60 Minutes and, you know, a bunch of TV shows. Anyway, she had a vocabulary, honestly, of over 1,000 words. And then because of that, and because of the research that her dad did with her, all of a sudden everybody wanted to research dog cognition, you know, what they could do with their brain. Chaser was so smart. Ooh, there must be other smart dogs out there. Let's check this out. What I love now, and I think this is going to help dogs so, so much. Now it's shifted from not just like how smart the dog is, but what does the dog feel? There was a time 20 years ago when if you had mentioned that any animal could feel, you would have been considered crazy. that was anthropomorphic, and animals didn't have feelings, right? Well, they do, you know, and now there's a whole bunch of really cool studies out there about how dogs feel. So we're finally, thankfully starting to recognize, oh my gosh, you know, dogs have a brain and they think and they make judgments and they also have feelings, you know, and the bond that we form with them starts with the strongest feeling of all, which is love, and then trust, and then respect. Those are the three major components of a really strong, healthy bond with a dog.
That's amazing. The three magic words. That's awesome. Thank you for that insight. We're just going to have a quick break, and when we get back, we'll continue talking with Debbie.
Molly, here's your dinner. Zeus, that's not your food.
Don't let that happen to your precious cat. Elevate your cat's eating experience with the Cat Tree Tray. The Cat Tree Tray keeps your cat's food off the floor and conveniently located on the cat tree. It's the perfect way to eat. It's a beautiful wrought iron tray that easily attaches to your cat tree and keeps dogs and other critters out of your cat's dish. A must for multi-pet households. There's a 6-inch tray for large bowls and a 4-inch tray for smaller bowls. Purchase your cat tree tray today. Go right now to cattreetray.com. That's cattreetray.com. CATTREETRAY.com.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Save a Pooch. We are talking with rescue dog advocate Debbie. Thank you so much for that insight before the break. Can you repeat the three famous words that build a strong, trusting bond between human and canine?
I think of it as a three-legged stool, and the first leg is love. And if you can remember meeting a dog for that first time, it's truly like your heart just expands. I mean, you just know in every cell of your body that, oh my gosh, this dog is, I just love this dog. And then it expands, it gets bigger to embrace trust, and then even bigger to embrace mutual respect back and forth.
Absolutely. Which brings us to our next topic that is close to your heart. Can you walk us through the challenges you faced when you discovered Nora, or your past dog, I guess, was a fear biter, particularly triggered by men, and the methods that you found effective in helping her overcome her fears and building trust?
2 weeks after I brought Nora home, Bev, and I had been visiting her in the shelter every afternoon for like, oh my gosh, 10 days.
What's her breed?
She was a shepherd mix. She looked like a kind of a blonde, sort of little bit scaled down shepherd, but she wasn't a 100% shepherd. So I knew from all my years of pet sitting, if I adopted a dog, my whole life would change. And it wasn't about putting a litter box out or anything. I'd have to walk this dog. I knew all the responsibilities, but I really, really, really thought that I was ready, you know, to open my heart and my home to a dog. And I fell in love with her. I mean, I mean, it was like a Disney moment. The sun was beaming down and I could hear violins in the background almost. I mean, really, it was just, oh boy.
That's awesome.
So I brought her home after about 10 days of visiting her every day in the shelter, and she met my cats, and one of my cats kind of freaked out, but he eventually calmed down and everything seemed to be stabilizing after about 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then right about at 2 weeks, one of the fellows who had helped build my garage had to come over and do some last minute work. And he was sitting at one point, he was sitting on the back steps and he was having lunch. And I knew that he had dogs of his own. And I knew he was a gentle man. And I said, Walt, would you like to meet my new dog? And he goes, sure. You know, so she went out and she was sitting next to him, Bev, on the back steps. And he was feeding her little pieces of his lunch. I mean, it was just my heart filled up. And I thought, oh my gosh, she's getting along with the cats. And now she's getting along with Walt. And oh, this is great. So I turned away from the back door. I don't know what I was doing, but I got distracted by something. And the next, a couple of minutes later, Walt opened the door and he said, "Your dog just tried to bite me."
Oh, geez.
And I thought, what? I mean, I thought I knew this dog, Bev. I thought I had vetted her. I thought I had made sure. I had not seen any sign of aggression in her at all. Not toward me, not toward my cats, not toward. So I was in shock. And I remember my stomach kind of did a flip. And anyway, I panicked. I absolutely panicked. A few days later, another guy came over to do some work on the house. And he told me that he and his wife had to just put down their shepherd. And I thought, oh, well, maybe this is a sign from God. I said, well, you know, my dog isn't really working out. And I'm ashamed to admit this today. But anyway, long story short, they took her. About 2 days later, they took her. And about 2 hours after I had dropped her off, the wife called me and said that she had run away. Now, did she really run away? Or did she try to bite her husband? I don't know. I wasn't there. So now I have this dog who I'd only had for a little over 2 weeks, and now she's out in the desert. This is Arizona. There are scorpions and, you know, rattlesnakes and coyotes and javelina. I mean, and by now it's May. It was getting up to into the 80s during the day. There's very little water. And I thought, what have I done? I felt terrible. I immediately contacted a friend. She made up a poster for me. I posted signs all over town. I called animal control. I called the local radio station. I did everything I could think of. And I just waited by the phone. It was before I had a cell phone. And finally, that was on a Thursday. I got a call on Sunday morning from the shelter. And they said, "We think your dog is behind the building." And I just raced over there and I'm praying, just please, please let her be there. It was her. And when she recognized my voice, she came running over. And I, at that moment, I said to myself, I don't know how I'm going to figure this out. I don't know what to do or not to do, but we will figure this out. And I will never, ever let go of you again. So the first thing I did was I thought, okay, I live in an area. My neighborhood had a riding stable, and the riding stable had made an arrangement with the Forest Service. Our whole neighborhood was surrounded by beautiful Forest Service land, and the riding stable put trails in. So I thought, okay, why don't I just try hiking with her on the trails? We were far away from cars. You know, chances are we wouldn't meet any other people or dogs or anything. So we started hiking every single morning for like an hour. And do you know that, like, probably that first week, Nora would come home, have breakfast, and flop down and take a nap. That was the first time she'd ever just took a nap and didn't follow me all over the house and wondered where I was. And, you know, she finally started to calm down. So I thought, okay, this is good. Then we live just outside of Sedona, Arizona, which is a big tourist town.
Yes.
There's a part of Sedona where all the tourist buses stop, and it's called Uptown. So I thought, okay, why don't we just start walking there? You know, there's a lot of people. It was too much for her. I tried bringing her to a soccer game. That was too much. So I quickly realized I had to back off and let her kind of guide me. If she started to kind of freeze up and if I ran my hands down her sides and there was a lot of muscular tension, I just thought, okay, this is too much right now. We're going to have to, you know, go down a side street, or we're going to have to, you know, go someplace else. And this is too overwhelming. I can tell you this, though. We started going to different soccer fields at the beginning of the soccer season. By the end of the soccer season, Nora knew where all the fields were. And when she realized that we were pulling up to another soccer field, by the end of the season, she was whirling around in the back seat. She couldn't wait to get out and say hello to everybody, but I just had to be patient. If she wasn't ready to go to the bleachers yet, I had to just, you know, hang out kind of near them and let her just stand there and, you know, and then maybe next game, a little closer to the bleachers, and oh, then we can actually go up maybe walk on the bleachers. It was well worth every single minute I put into it.
Wow.
She changed. She absolutely changed. You know, she became a new dog.
That's amazing that you put in that much. You're committed. You're committed. And oh, if only people were just that committed to the healing journey of the dog, because exactly, like, some of them may need shorter time. Some of them may need longer time. The shortest I've seen was 2 weeks, but it seems like in your case, maybe months.
I would say from start to finish, it was almost 2 years, because it was really, in the beginning, it was like 3 steps forward and 4 steps back. She'd seem to make, you know, like one day she would make a lot of progress and we'd go back to the same place and it was like starting all over again. And so just keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it. And a lot of trainers and behaviorists say that that is flooding. If the dog truly, truly is becoming that overwhelmed, stop. You don't want to cause more damage. You don't want to flood them or overwhelm them. But I believe it's important to help dogs face their fears. If my mother had given up on me and never brought me to kindergarten, I might never have gotten an education, you know? I mean, I'm glad she hung in there with me, right?
Right.
I knew this dog was smart. I knew she was sweet and loving. It was like watching a flower bloom in slow motion, very slow motion. But eventually I could see this beautiful rose all, you know, in full bloom. It took a long time, but it was worth waiting for. By the time, gosh, I actually trained, I got Nora to be able to walk by the side of a road when there were cars going by.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, she would have done anything for me. We took a fun agility class together. That was one of the best bonding experiences. It was a great experience for her to meet other dogs and meet other people. She was very athletic anyway. You know, her nickname by the end of the class was Rocket Dog because she tried so hard. She was so fast. We all cheered each other's dogs on. It was fun. Agility for a lot of dogs is a wonderful, wonderful way to bond with your dog. I highly recommend it.
Oh yeah. I support that sport. It looks fun. It sounds fun. I'm sure it's a lot of work.
You know, I mean, once the dog gets the hang of, you know, okay, this is a jump or this is the tunnel or whatever. Once they kind of like get a few things down,
right,
it kind of triggers them to try more. And, oh, you want me to go up this A-frame? Okay, no problem. I can do, you know, they just, it sort of, I don't know. It once they can do one or two things really easily, yeah, they love it. But there was this, it's funny, there was this one dog in our class. He was older. He may have had, I think he probably had arthritis or something. He would do everything in the course, but he would walk. He never ran at all. Never. But he did it. He still did it.
That's awesome. Oh, I'd love to see that.
It was so much fun. It was so much fun. Yeah.
Now, before we wrap up, let's talk about your current projects. What are you up to? What are you working on?
Well, I just recently submitted a book proposal. I've been writing a book about Nora and, you know, sort of what I think of as zooming in on her and then zooming back out. The title of the book, the working title of the book, is called By the Grace of Dog, and it's lessons that Nora taught me. You know, she
That's nice.
Thank you. She was the light of my life. She changed my life. She helped me become a better person, and she's also helped me work with other dogs. I always think of her when I work with other dogs. So I just recently submitted the proposal to a literary agent in New York. And this is a woman I selected in part because she has dogs of her own and she's competed in agility with them. And I thought, ooh, you know, maybe she'll be interested in this. And I hope she is, because I'd love to get this book out there. I would love to have people understand that when you are rehabilitating a dog, just be patient and understand that it will take them as long as it takes.
Exactly.
Always be supportive of them, always encourage them, always praise them when they get it. You know, I mean, and you can see massive changes in dogs in very little time. But you kind of have to put yourself in the dog's paws and feel what the world must feel like for them. How overwhelming is it for them?
Absolutely. And it does take a little bit of effort to be self-aware and observant. But Nora, you prove that you can.
Yeah.
And especially when you came from a position of having doubts. Yeah, you came a long way. That's awesome. I love hearing about that.
You know, I think those 3 nights that Nora was missing in the desert, I remember saying, you know, God, if I ever get another chance to be with this dog, I promise I will never, you know, I will figure this out. I just give me another chance, please. You know, and you know, it took a while, but I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful that I was reunited with her. And I find it kind of, I mean, today I can kind of laugh about it, but she didn't try to find her way back to my home. She found her way back to
the shelter. Right.
What does that tell you?
Oh, wow. Oh, boy. Well, we are out of time. I really appreciate you, Debbie, for being here, and our show producer, Mark Winter, for making the show possible. And if people want to keep in touch with your book, what is the best way for them to do so? We'll put your email also on the show page.
Yes. Probably if you're interested in doing a dog behavior consultation, please send me an email, which you mentioned is on your webpage now. I'm happy to do this on Zoom. I can do it on the phone. I've done it, you know, once the pandemic started, and I will give your listeners a discount. So any questions you have, I've also done dog behavior classes, which I love doing. And now that we, you know, everybody does Zoom, I am more than happy to gather together a group of people, maybe 5 or 6 people, for 5 or 6 weeks, and we can focus on anything that they need to work on with their dog.
Awesome. Thank you for that offer. Very generous. And if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for a show, please email me at beverly@petliferadio.com. So until next time, spread animal compassion.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.